There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Pixels, a podcast for the discerning gamer.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to Pixels. My name is Patrick Beja, and we talk about video games. We talk about the news from the past couple of weeks, and to help me do that today, I have the return of the dynamic duo, Dan and Ed. Well, you're on the show together once, so I figured we'd do something special. Ed is, of course, with the 4Player Network. You've been on the show many times. Welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Daniel Ahmad is, I don't know how to describe you anymore. I would say the best comedy tweet writer in the video games industry, who also happens to double as a brilliant analyst in that industry. Does that work for you?
Yeah, I imagine it does. I mean, the second part is obviously the more professional sounding one that I prefer. but yeah, both work fine. And it's good to be back on.
Thank you for being on. I've been, of course, I avidly follow everything you tweet, and I see the ratio of humor in your tweets increase. So I think you're getting a little bit more at ease with the Twitter medium, and I like it. So I'm just.
True. I mean, it'd be really boring if I just posted random statistics and all that nonsense 24/7. So you've got to mix it up a bit.
Yeah, I agree.
Now I feel like I'm not doing that well in my Twitter space because of that. Thanks, Patrick.
Well, you can learn from the master because he's here today.
Yeah.
So there you go.
There you go.
All right, so we have a bunch of stuff we're going to talk about today. A few news items for the Switch. As I like to joke now, it's basically nonstop until the release, although that's going to happen really soon now. And we have a few interesting numbers and announcements, most notably from Activision Blizzard, who's reported record numbers. We have news from Valve. If you'll believe it, they have made a couple of announcements and a bunch of other things. And just a quick note that this show is a little bit early because I'll be off next week. So if I don't tweet, it's either because I'm just enjoying my holiday or because I've been abducted by the Russian Secret Service. So I'm going to be in Russia is why I'm saying. So I'll be back a week after that. So if I don't show up on your Twitter feeds at that point, send help. All right. With that out of the way, news items for the Switch. The biggest one, obviously, is the announcement that there's going to be a DLC pack, a season pack pass of sorts for Breath of the Wild for Zelda. And the reaction has been mixed. Some people are thinking, usual DLC reaction. You're not giving us the full game. What is this? Zelda should be complete when you buy it. Rah, rah, rah. And on the opposite side is, that's interesting. We haven't had season passes for Zelda before, for full Zeldas before. But it's not like Nintendo hasn't been selling in-game content in the past. And I will see, as we'll see later in the show, in-game content is becoming a bigger and bigger deal all the time. So any reaction to the season pack? It's going to be season pass. It's going to be $20, and it's going to have basically two pieces of content, one in summer and one in winter, with the winter one being a new adventure to go on.
So I have no problems with like the new adventure part. The one that's in the summer, which is like a cave, it's called the Cave Trials, and it's basically like a lot of the Zelda games have like this gauntlet that you have to go through to get like a heart piece or something like that. And it's probably the hardest heart piece to get in the game. The fact that that's a DLC is kind of a little weird. I don't know what the reward is going to be for that, but if it's like another heart container or something like that, then maybe that feels a little weird. But the extra content pack with new dungeon, new story, that's perfectly fine with me. That doesn't bother me at all. I know that I love Zelda, so nothing's going to stop me from getting this game. And I'll probably wait till after the summer one comes out before I actually get the season pass. I don't believe in buying any season passes before all the DLC comes out for it. Just doesn't make any sense to me. You should be aware of what you're buying, just like anything else.
Fair enough. Daniel, I guess it didn't surprise you that Nintendo is trying to get more money out of the super fans of Zelda while offering new content as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's 2017, and this kind of thing is expected from every company, even Nintendo. Mm-hmm. As you said before, you know, this is something that Nintendo have hinted at doing for a long time now. If you look at all their games on Wii U, you know, Splatoon, Mario Kart, Smash Bros., they will have some kind of add-on content or, you know, in-game content, whether it's free or paid. And this is just the same thing here. And yeah, I mean, what Ed said, you know, it's wise to wait and see what exactly is in those packs. But I think some people who have overreacted are treating it as if this is, you know, Assassin's Creed 2 back in 2009.
Right.
And
right.
All the DLCs on the disc and, you know, it's all that nonsense. But, you know, today, the way it works is that the game has already gone gold. It's already finished development.
Yeah.
All this content is being developed after the game, and it's there to, you know, enhance the game for people who might pick it up later, you know, people who pick it up on day one as well. And it helps keep them engaged and playing in that title through the rest of the year.
And I think that's a smart decision, right? Because they spent thousands upon thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars, maybe even millions on this game. And it's going to be their flagship title for the Switch, and they want people to stay in their on their system and get engaged with it and talk about it. So I have no problem with them wanting to do this. If it gives me more content and brings me back into the game after I've already finished it, that's fine with me. When I picked up Skyward Sword and I finished it completely, I didn't go back to that game. And Zeldas don't have... They have a lot of replay value in a nostalgia sense, but they don't have a lot of actual replay value. And as far as like once you solve the puzzles, you pretty much know them, right? So having entirely new pieces of content to consume in a Zelda game is something that we haven't seen before, besides waiting for the next Zelda game.
Right. It feels like this is... 100% agree. Oh, go ahead, Daniel.
No, 100% agree with what Ed said.
I think it's a balancing act, and we've sort of figured out in the industry what the right balance is. Because if you take content out of the initial game, if it feels like you take content out of the initial game to sell it back as DLC afterwards, the consumer is going to feel that, and if they feel they're not going to get a fair deal, they're going to complain about it. If you do provide enough content for that extra price, what ends up happening is that the most engaged audience, the most engaged gamers that want more out of the game and that would like to be immersed in that universe for longer can do that. And in the process, you're getting more money for it. So you're monetizing your most loyal and dedicated customers. So it makes sense if it works like this. And on top of that, as we mentioned, in-game content is a huge part of the industry right now, and there's no reason that anyone should be insulated from these kinds of operations if, again, the balance is right. So hopefully it will be here as well, but it shouldn't be a surprise that Nintendo is going there as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys saw these, but there have been a number of 1-2 Switch commercials, which I was very surprised about, because they sort of did the unthinkable. They made me think that 1-2 Switch might be fun in some specific situations. Basically, it's Japanese ads that show people playing 1-2 Switch in a crowd. It's, you know, a bunch of people, maybe 10 people around the two players, and there's often kids being involved, and they're, you know, cheering for the people who win and yelling, and it's like this party game, not in the sense that, you know, Wii Sports was a party game where the action would be focused on the game itself and on the screen, and people would cheer, of course, but it was more of a passive experience, whereas here with these ads, it's like it's cheering as if it was like, I don't know, a tug war,
an audience, or, yeah, in some, yeah, sort of
performance game, right? Yeah. So yeah. I'm not saying I'm going to play it. I still think it's dumb, especially if it's just two players or whatever. Wii Sports could be played with two players. Here, it's really if you have a crowd. But I think in this context, I could see the fun in it. Maybe at a, you know, a kid's birthday party or something like this. Maybe. So me going from this is the dumbest thing ever to maybe in the right conditions is kind of incredible already. So
I think the dumbest thing ever is that it's not packed into the system. Yeah. That's just not cool, man. if they want anyone to play this game and show off the new hardware, it should have been baked in.
Well, they can always. I think they can always do release a demo. Afterwards, with three games.
I think what they're gonna do is by the time Christmas rolls around, they're gonna have a new like version of the console, quote unquote, packed in. With this game packed in, like a bundle.
But I really think the demo is going to happen 3-4 months down the line. And that, mm-hmm. as a demo of the capabilities of the console, works well enough. So if you have that from the beginning, then you lose out on the sales of that thing. So,
yeah. And I had the Switch pre-ordered. So, and the first day that I get it, I'm going to bring it into work and all the engineers, and we're all going to play it. So,
of course.
We're gonna have a lot of fun and with annoy one, two, all
switch?
The other.
Do you have one, yeah, two, switch? Well,
that's gonna happen. I'm annoyed, but only enough that I can only talk about it because I'm buying it anyway.
Yeah.
I have no intention of really getting it, to be honest.
But, yeah, you're resisting.
You know, it looks okay. Well, I mean, I'm getting Zelda obviously on day one. That's about it until.
Oh, on the Switch, right. No, I thought you were saying you have no intention of getting the Switch.
Oh, no, I'm getting the Switch, but I don't have any intention of getting a 1-2 Switch.
Right.
The party game, which looks okay, but isn't.
Yeah, the party game that looks okay, but isn't, I think is a great description of that thing. And I'm not getting it either. Ed, you're alone. There's okay. Also a first-person mode for Ultra Street Fighter 2. That was kind of confirmed, even though there were a few seconds in the presentation. Like first person mode for Street Fighter 2, I don't get it. Anyway, that's not making it better in any way. But all right, let's move on to something else. Numbers and announcements from Activision. We've had a few end of year things announced here and there, and Activision has been pretty amazing. I mean, for all of the things we're going to talk about, we have to keep in mind that they acquired King, which is a huge mobile game developer and publisher. And so King currently represents 25% of their total revenue, but that's still their revenue increased from $4.6 billion in 2015 to $6.6 in 2016. That's kind of insane, even with the inclusion of King, which, you know, represents a lot of that. The in-game content we were talking about is 36% of that total, $6.6 billion. Again, King is probably a big part of that because there are a lot of free-to-play and that's all in-game content, but still. And digital represents $4.8 billion, which is more than the total for 2015. Once again, King has been acquired, so that is something to keep in mind. But that's huge. And talking about huge numbers, any learning, anything that surprised you, Daniel, in these yearly results?
Well, for Activision Blizzard, really, it was more of a confirmation that the company's now become the, you know, huge entertainment company that they wanted to become, you know, a decade ago. I think one stat in particular that really, you know, struck me was that they said in 2016 alone, you know, players spent 43 billion hours watching and playing Activision Blizzard games, mm-hmm. which is actually more more hours than people spend watching Netflix content. Mm. And so that's a really interesting stat that just shows me that, you know, these guys have got a great portfolio of games and content across mobile, PC, console now. And, you know, there's some good things coming out. I mean, Blizzard had a great year last year with the introduction of Overwatch and, you know, the Warcraft movie and a new expansion pack for World of Warcraft as well. And, you know, Blizzard actually generated more than Activision last year, which is a first for, you know, I think ever.
It's Blizzard is 39% of their revenue and Activision 36%.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was a record year for Blizzard. Again, thanks to Overwatch and Warcraft
and Legion. Yeah,
And I think that the majority of that 4.8 billion is digital sales from Blizzard.
Yeah, I mean,
just
it's because of Overwatch.
No, remember, there's King, and they also have a lot of in-game content and digital for Call of Duty, even though it sells less well than it did before. But yeah, Daniel.
Yeah,
no, I mean, King's the majority there, but Blizzard as well, obviously on the PC front, is fairly large. But I think one thing that's quite surprising is how Activision, I mean, didn't really do much last year, and the future outlook for them is a bit interesting because Call of Duty really underperformed last year. There's no new Skylanders game in 2017. And really, when you look at what Activision are doing as their own kind of branch, they've really only got kind of Call of Duty and Destiny as the two big franchises. And so it's going to be interesting to see what they do going forward with Destiny 2 and whether Call of Duty 2017 is able to rejuvenate the franchise in a positive direction.
Well, I think that they're putting their foot forward by entering into the like content creation market with that new division that they have, right? They see the writing on the wall with these games that aren't selling as well as they used to. I mean, Skylanders obviously is not selling at all, which is why they put it on hiatus. They're trying to diversifying their portfolio in a way that is going to allow them to remain successful over the years.
It's certainly they're trying to. I mean, as you mentioned, Skylanders is on hiatus. Call of Duty, they said, is going back to its roots, which I guess World War II, which is going to look really weird after Battlefield 1 went to World War I, is going to look like trying to copy what Battlefield 1 did, which I very much doubt it would be because they would have started development a while ago for this year's Call of Duty. It's usually on a 2-year cycle. But yeah, they have Destiny 2 and Call of Duty, and that's basically it for Activision. We have that, are they publishing the Insomniac? I think it's Insomniac, doing the Spider-Man game.
I think that's Sony publishing that.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, there you go. They don't have that anymore. And still they're enormous. I wonder though, I couldn't find exact numbers, I don't think, but Daniel, maybe you can tell me. They're now clearly the biggest publisher for the gaming industry, right? But, you know, they're doing the biggest revenue. But how does it compare to the other big ones, you know, the EAs, the Ubisoft, the Tencent, even if we want to go to the Asian market?
Sure. I mean, it's certainly the biggest publisher in North America, without a doubt. As in based in North America. I mean, you know, they generated revenues of $6.6 billion in 2016 compared to EA, which was about $4.5 billion. Ubisoft was about $1.5 billion. Take-Two was about $1.6 billion. So they're definitely the biggest publisher there. But when you compare it to, you know, Tencent, it's not even in the same ballpark, because Tencent's a $13 billion online gaming company.
$13 billion revenue?
Yeah, that's from their, you know, obviously they own Supercell and Riot Games.
Of course.
So that boosted a bit, but...
No, but they also own like WeChat and other like messaging apps and things like that.
Sure, but the 13 billion actually excludes that.
Oh, does it? Okay. Wow.
Yeah, the 13 billion is just their gaming division, which is absolutely huge in China. And then obviously Supercell is huge in Western markets for mobile, and Riot Games with League of Legends obviously is massive worldwide.
Supercell is the maker of Clash of Clans, for those who didn't know.
And Sensor Tower just published an analysis that said that estimates the revenue for the first year of Clash Royale to about $1 billion, which, you know, that is
just one game.
Yeah, one
crazy
of the games of the very successful developer Supercell, which is one of the incredibly successful companies that Tencent owns or works with.
Just also, their online...
Yeah.
Sorry, Patrick. Just their online ad revenue jumped 7.5 billion, or not jumped 7.5, but is up to 7.5 billion, which is up 51% year over year.
That's insane. Pretty amazing. And they benefit from... you know, the way things work in China, the way the law is established in China, that means anyone wanting to do business in China has to partner with a Chinese company. And for example, mm-hmm. they have partnerships with Blizzard, which we were just talking about, to distribute some of their games in China, including Overwatch. It's Tencent, right? Is it Tencent? I'm not.
It's not sure Tencent right for Blizzard.
Oh, okay.
So Tencent operates Call of Duty Online.
Okay.
Free-to-play version of Call of Duty, but it's NetEase in China that operates.
Of course,
Blizzard games.
NetEase,
yeah. Of course, yeah. They're
and NetEase actually, you know, they're bigger than. Well, I mean, they're as big as EA, revenue-wise, and the majority of their revenues again is just from China. So, I mean, one statistic I can give you is if you combine Tencent and NetEase's revenues, which would be about 17 billion, give or take, that's actually bigger than Activision Blizzard, Electronic Arts, Ubisoft, and Take-Two combined. So that really gives you a bit of perspective on how big these, you know, giant Chinese gaming companies are.
Yeah, and it's not like those you mentioned for Europe or for the West are small. They're already enormous.
Well, no, they are the big four. They're the four biggest. They're the four biggest gaming companies that operate in the console space, and obviously have PC and mobile businesses too.
All right. Well, there you go. Any other numbers? And I guess a couple of other things. Well, just one. Destiny 2 is still on track for 2017. That makes me happy personally, because you know how much I love Destiny 1. but we'll see what happens. They mentioned they were going to broaden the appeal of the franchise. I'm guessing that means a more solid single player experience and possibly a PC release. We'll see what happens, but... I'm excited about that one. Any other interesting numbers or things that are worth mentioning outside of the gigantic nature of the Chinese publishers?
Well, one thing that, I mean, just going back to the Chinese publishers here, one thing that NetEase announced yesterday is that Overwatch has now sold 5 million copies in China alone, and that's paid copies. So, you know, the game costs around $30 there, so it's a you know, one-off payment, similar to the West, actually, which is quite good. But I think what's quite surprising, and a lot of people who perhaps cover the Chinese market will tell you, is that everyone goes free-to-play in China, because no one buys, you know, full-priced games. And, okay, that's not strictly true, because people do buy them, but in general, that's not the rule. But what we've seen with Blizzard and Overwatch in this case is, you know, 5 million people have paid for it. And it's really because Blizzard have built up their stable franchises, you know, such as Warcraft, Hearthstone, and the others as well. and they've been really well received in China. And that's why Overwatch has been able to actually do quite well there. Because you put any other game there, charge $30 to it, it would never sell 5 million. I'll tell you that.
So what do you think happened? Was it just the fact that it's, you know, they're used to, you know, to the idea of paying money to Blizzard because they like that company? Or what was it?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, one, it's a great game. You know, there's a lot of great feedback online and, you know, via the, I guess, esports and live streaming as well. And, yeah, when it comes to Blizzard games, obviously Warcraft is subscription-based. So people do have that knowledge that, you know, Blizzard can usually charge. Mm. And in this case, the game is just worth it for a lot of people, that they're more than happy to spend the money.
Yeah. I guess it says something about the Chinese market as well, that there are enough gamers that are willing to spend $30, which is very close. Well, basically, it's $40 here in the West. So it's almost the same. And they're able, beyond the aspect of being willing to, but they're able to pay that kind of money for a game, which means the market is maturing very quickly in China. It wasn't so long ago that you would imagine the Chinese market wasn't able to bear that kind of pricing for these kinds of games. So, interesting
indeed.
Yeah, I mean,
in free-to-play, you know, people spend loads. But when it comes to paid games, piracy is obviously a big issue in China. And also just a general, you know, there's a free version of a game. Why would you pay for a full-priced version? Mm. And so those are the general attitudes that you see there. And that's why it's quite refreshing to see Overwatch actually do quite well as a paid game.
Which, it just to be clear, they also have the equivalent of PC bangs from Korea. Like, you can go and pay for the amount of time you're going to play, right? That's true. The way that, yeah. And I see, I guess, Ed added the bit of news. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, so it was announced yesterday, I think, that Resident Evil 7 has completely recouped its development cost. And it, by that, they mean they sold 3 million copies, and they expect for the entire fiscal year to sell 4 million copies.
So I think their target was for fiscal year, which means end March.
Yeah, so that's pretty good for a game that, like, is a sequel to a game that was generally thought of as not a great addition to the franchise. And the franchise is starting to, like, go downhill, and all of a sudden this game's, and I played it, and it's pretty dang fun.
It's interesting.
There's at least one girly scream that you got out of me playing that game.
It's interesting because Resident Evil 6 sold well. It sold really well, but from a critic's point of view, it wasn't regarded as a great version of the game, and they had the courage to change up the formula, and it's really encouraging that the game sold well enough, and, you know, it's basically a success. It means that developers like Capcom and maybe others will be more willing to mix things up.
They took a pretty big risk with this game. The critic response to 6 was so low that they took a lot of the suggestions and stuff, and, like, talking about like what made the original Resident Evil and Resident Evil 4 especially so great, and they really seem to have turned it around and made something that no one was really expecting. People were hoping, but no one was really, like, expecting it to come true.
So good news there too. Hey, want more good news? Valve is doing things that are games and not just the store. So they announced during an interview, they basically, we talked, I think, about the Gabe Newell AMA on Reddit a few weeks ago, and now they had basically a press conference. It was an interview with lots of journalists where they announced a bunch of things, one of them being that they're making 3 full VR games. We had the legitimate question of whether or not Valve was still interested in making games because they're making so much money with Steam. But it seems they are, and they're making 3 complete VR games, which might be sequels, no one say, you know, the game that shall not be named. I doubt that would be it, but there are opportunities. Of course, everyone talks about a game in the Portal universe that seems like a no-brainer. But yeah, they're still making games. They believe in VR. They did mention that, you know, maybe it's not going to be, maybe by the time the games come out, they're going to have different types of VR headsets that are more capable. And they also are working on a Oculus Touch-like hardware device that would make the controls even more different from what we already know. Newell talked about Miyamoto and the fact that basically something that Steve Jobs also used to say, which is if you're really serious about software, you have to develop your own hardware as well. And that's something Nintendo does a lot, of course. And now Valve is talking about it. So I guess it's probably going to be playable on the current headset, on the HTC Vive, but there are probably going to be other ones that come out where it's going to be even better in the near future, I'm sure, or at least, you know, that's what was implied. But yeah, three full VR games from Valve. Are we excited?
I'd say so. I mean, I think that the problem with VR right now is there's no, like, real, like, a platform seller in a way. All of them seem kind of like tech demos. So if there are full-fledged video games that are all in, that are completely in VR, I think that it could really do benefit to selling the those platforms. Someone on the site played Resident Evil 7 and completely in VR, and he said it was the most terrifying experience he'd ever had in a video game. So I think that as like big developers say, like, hey, it is possible to make a game completely in VR and have it be a game, then other publishers and developers will jump on that track too, and hopefully and create a nice ecosystem of games that are available for people to play in VR.
Yeah, it's also very reassuring, I think, to see that Valve believes in VR enough to commit to three full games. It probably means that that's all they're doing, except for minor updates to, you know, CSGO and Team Fortress, and of course Dota 2. But yeah, it's probably a good thing. And then they announced a change to the way they accept games on the Steam platform. Basically, Steam Greenlight is going away. And they're going to put in place Steam Direct, which is going to mean any developer. For those who don't remember, Greenlight, well, okay, let's go back for a second. Steam is a platform that only accepts on the platform games that Valve has selected. So you have to be, you know, greeted into the fold of the Church of the Light of Gabe Newell to be featured in the store. Of course, many, many games are, but not every game. And Greenlight was a way for the Steam community to surface games they were interested in and to bring them to the attention of the people who, by some arcane method, decide which games are going to be on the platform. That worked for a couple of years, but there were numerous issues and, you know, it had good sides and bad sides, but what they're doing now is that they're basically going to an app store-like model. If you have a game that is functional, if it, you know, works on the platform that you says, if it launches on the platforms you say it launches on, and you have basic administrative solvency, if you're basically the bank account, then they mentioned the kind of administrative thing you would need to comply to is the equivalent of opening a bank account. And then you have the choice of paying a certain amount between $100 and $5,000. They haven't decided exactly how much it would be. And then you are on the Steam store, just like you would be on the Apple App Store or any other store of that kind. And there is sort of a backlash against this from certain developers. Some people mentioned that some games like children's school projects or games from developers that are incredibly poor and that put all their efforts and time and energy into that one game, and they won't have $5,000 to put it on Steam, which, by the way, the $5,000 are refundable. We don't know exactly how they will be refundable, if it's on profits or if Steam just pays them back or pays part of it and half of it is profits. We don't know. But if some developer doesn't have that kind of money, well, they would be excluded from the store. And I'm curious to know what you guys think about this. I have my own opinions, but I'll ask you first. Daniel, is that, do you see the drawbacks or and the benefits to this, or what do you think?
Yeah, the two big drawbacks to this is that upfront fee. Yes, it's refundable, but I'm a bit confused why Valve announced this without setting a price or without articulating that point a bit better. Okay, fair enough, they've given a range of 100 to 5,000, but that's a fairly big range, and it really just depends on the developer and the region and the project, because for some, 5,000 is fine. For others, it's something that they can't afford. And the second point really is around the discoverability of games and how that will work. Is that going to mean that you're not seeing the best games, or you're only seeing some games and not others? You're going to miss the gems. So I mean, those are the two big drawbacks that I see. But in general, for Steam and for Valve, it makes a lot of sense with what they're doing, because they're opening up the platform so that anyone can publish a game, without need for this curation and long waiting time. And so what that means is that, Steam can continue growing as a platform. They have a huge market share at the moment, but they don't want competition to come in. And so by having all the PC games on Steam, really, that again makes it the one-stop shop for all PC games. On top of that, moving away from Greenlight means that a lot of these developers now can take that budget, that marketing budget that they had for just being approved, just to get on the store, and actually use it for promotion and marketing for when they're on the store on day one. So, that uncertainty of will I or won't I get on the store, and is it worth investing in this product to go through Greenlight? Is it actually going to go through? That uncertainty is now gone, and it's just a fee that needs to be explained a bit more and kind of talked about. And once we get a clear answer on that, that's when everyone can start forming opinions.
Well, I think it's just
very quickly, it's a very good point, sure, about the fact that Greenlight, as we mentioned, wasn't a given. You also had to invest either time or money or both to actually get noticed on Greenlight and be published. So that uncertainty of whether or not you could ever be on the store, is very heavy to bear by especially a small development studio.
And a lot of developers would prefer that that Greenlight wasn't there, and that you can just put your game on the store. Yes, it means there's a lot of crap games that are going to go on, but if discoverability works like it should, shouldn't be an issue. But obviously, never does it.
Well, it's the same problem in all of the app stores. You have so many products and that's obviously a problem. But I think personalized discovery and they've changed the store quite a bit to try and cater to your tastes. And it never works perfectly, but I think that solution seems better than just artificially keeping a lot of people out of the store.
I think the reason that so many indie devs aren't happy about it is because they're switching from the model right now, which is $100 as a development studio, to more than 100, potentially up to 5,000 is what they said, per project. So you can understand why that that numbers wise, I mean, you have to spend time marketing with Greenlight right now, but you don't have to spend $5,000 per game that you're making to market towards Greenlight, you know? I think this move is good, but it might be they probably should have done this before they even tried Greenlight. More games were published on Steam last year than ever before that.
Yeah.
And that doesn't say to me, hey, look, you should look for all these awesome games that are on there. That means, hey, there's a lot of crap on this platform. And they have done a lot of inroads to making discoverability better, more filters and stuff on during sales. Back in 2015, you used to have to, like, in order to find out if a game was in early access that was listed on the front page, you had to open up the game and look for early access. And now you can filter those out to your front page results during the sales and stuff like that. Though all those things are really positive things for the platform. I just hope that we don't lose out on indie developers that there were a couple of awesome gems that made it through Greenlight. And I'm hoping that we don't lose out on that.
Yeah, I think it's a legitimate concern. I think no solution is perfect, obviously. Mm-hmm. There are going to be drawbacks in both cases. I'm sure they do have to keep a gate at some point so that we don't see even more crap. You know, if there is absolutely no difficulty in being on the platform, then you start seeing clones and the games, you know, the platform flooded with very, very poor quality things, which there might be still now, but probably not as much. I guess that $5,000 per game figure is a little bit high. It's a little bit high. I'm guessing they're not going to go that high, but we'll see. It's also refundable, so it makes sure that it's a way of making sure that you have a serious, you know, maybe not business plan, but at least you're serious about the game that you're putting on the store. Which, if you're not, I understand some people might not be, or might even expect the game to not make that kind of money or whatever. There are also other avenues, and I think that's the other thing I was going to say. Yeah, you know, there's itch.io, there's good old games. You can put it on your website for the love of the almighty. Yeah. You know, put it on your website, put it free. That's how Minecraft started. So it's definitely possible. You have app stores if you want to go mobile. So Steam is important, but it's not the only player in town.
And PlayStation is making great inroads in the indie development community with the way that their publishing system works. Their self-publishing system works, I should say. So there are obviously multiple avenues that any indie developer can take. And if this new Steam Greenlight replacement doesn't seem to be pulling in developers, that's how the free market works, right? So it's if not as many indie devs are coming in, or Valve feels like they're missing out on people, they'll start to reduce that price, or maybe make it a little bit more proportional to the indie studio size or something like that, which would be kind of cool as well. Yeah,
good work. All right, a bunch of other tidbits. Twitch launched communities in beta a few days ago. If you don't know what that is, I thought that was a really interesting approach to the way the Twitch discoverability, which again seems to be a problem for everyone these days, works. Basically, anyone can create a community, and any channel can decide to become part of that community, but they can only be part of one community at a time. I mean, I'm saying any channel. Obviously, I'm sure there are moderating options in there for the creator of that community. But what that does is that you can create a community around a certain theme. For example, you might have a community of speedrunners, or a community about survival games only, or, you know, a lot of different kinds of ideas can now be inserted into the DNA of Twitch, and those things are searchable and they are discoverable, and you can talk about these in a way that is so much more practical than trying to go and find a certain type of stream only by, you know, the only options you have now is by game or by streamer name. So if you don't know those two, and if you have only the name of the game, chances are you're going to see the top 15 streamers, and that's it. You're probably not going to go anywhere below that. So I thought the community's idea was really clever. We'll have to see how much use that actually gets. But it's a great way of inserting searching and discoverability into the Twitch community in general, which is lacking in that department, I thought. Anyone cares to comment?
Yeah, it seems cool.
Yeah.
I'll be curious to... I actually didn't know about this, and I'm not sure that any of us on the site do. And we've been on Twitch for, I guess, 6 years now. So I'll take this back to them and see if it's something we're interested in.
Mm. Yeah, you can only be part of one community, so it's mm-hmm. very specific. But if you go to the site now, it's available in beta. But wait, let's check things out. Communities, there you go. There are speedrunning, Yo Video Games. I don't know what that is. Competitive Overwatch, for example.
Hearthstone Arena's up there, and seems kind of cool.
There can be stuff. Super Mario Maker, that's game. Overwatch, that's a game. Okay. Twitter Deutschland. So language based, I guess that's not too hard to find. Japan stream, okay, maybe UK streamers. You know what? Those communities aren't the best. I would have hoped they would be more original, but anyway, Marvel Comics down there. There's one stream in that community. I think the idea is cool. I'm not saying it will be implemented in the proper way. We'll see.
Mm-hmm.
All right, E3 is opening to regular people. Regular customers, you can buy your E3 ticket. I wonder if there are still some left, but there were 15,000 put up for sale, which, you know, it's really interesting. E3 is really struggling, has been for a few years, as, you know, obviously developers can go directly to their consumers, and that's a problem for a trade show that tries to have a wide consumer appeal, as E3 does in the publicity of it. But they have tried to make it a little bit more public, a little bit less public, and they're still not finding the best way of going about it. This time they're giving 15,000 extra people the possibility of going to the show. The price is pretty high. It's $150 for the first 1,000, which I'm sure is gone already.
It's $250 now.
Exactly, yeah. $250 now. I don't know if that's going to do E3 any good. I don't understand. I mean, I understand it brings money to them, but I don't think it brings, I guess that's what it does. It's it's money. Aside from that, it's still not a great moment to be in the trade show business. It's still good for people to get together and professionals to make deals, which is, I guess, what E3 is about. But... What do you think of it, Daniel? Is it something that is... I mean, when you look at Gamescom, for example, which has like 350,000 attendees, you go the other route, and that is, that's going to be positive cash flow size. I don't know. What's your thought on that E3 opening to 15,000 customers?
I think it's a good start for the direction E3 will probably look to go in over the next few years. Obviously, it's, you know, the retail trade show, and that's the primary reason for its existence. But, you know, it's time to, I guess, it's time for E3 to be a bit more inclusive. And, the way I see it is that this will encourage a few more exhibitors to really kind of, buy space there and show up. But also at the same time, I think it's going to bring in a few more influencers and, I guess, like super fans of the game, of games and franchises to these events. And, you know, that can actually be quite beneficial for these companies who you know, perhaps haven't seen a reason to buy a booth at E3, because as you say, they can go directly to the customer these days. But if they were to buy a booth at E3 and have, you know, perhaps YouTube influencers or Twitch streamers partner with them there, then it can actually be a lot more influential and better for the company than any sort of, you know, standard press release that they release at E3 normally.
That's an interesting way of looking at it, yeah.
It could work, and I think it's the best thing that they could have done, because if they kept it the same as last year, you know, it would have just been a continual decline.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense. I hadn't really thought of it that way. They can keep opening it up more if needed in the future, but getting people in might, again, enable some micro YouTubers, micro influencers that are going to go there for a couple of days and be interested in smaller games, because everyone is going to be talking about the big EA or Ubisoft releases, but there might be other games that might be interesting that the developers would be very happy to give access to someone that has a smaller audience, where when people, you know, big companies aren't really interested in someone, you know, a YouTuber that has 10,000 viewers, things like that. And it does work as a wonderful circle of life with the booth as well. You're right. It makes it way more appealing for developers to have a booth there if they know they're going to be able to reach more people. So yeah, I hadn't seen it like that, but it makes a lot of sense. All right, a series of additional bits. Amazon has opened a new studio that is led by John Smedley. If you don't remember who John Smedley is, he's the guy who was leading basically the EverQuest studio. And that is an MMO. And so that means that Amazon, who's been deep in development, they acquired Twitch a couple of years ago now, and they've been developing games and maybe something MMO-ish. It's very interesting that Amazon is really firing in all directions at the moment, including that one. So just wanted to mention it.
I have to admit, it's a bit weird what they're doing. I mean, it's great. I love it that, you know, they're opening up all these studios and creating different games to, you know, interact and integrate with Twitch. But if I was in Amazon's position, I probably would just, you know, get some developers on board to create games and obviously just publish them or whatever.
You mean instead of building up a studio internally?
Yeah, exactly. You know, they could have gone with the same procedure with their, what's their video service called? Amazon Video, is that it?
Amazon Prime Video.
Yeah.
Prime Video, yeah. So, I mean, I was thinking they might go something like that, because I don't know. I'm interested to see how it goes. It could be a huge success for them, or it could just be, I mean, if I was in that position, I probably wouldn't do it, but we'll see.
I guess the risk is really big. It's really difficult you don't have the expertise, they've hired a lot of very smart and very talented people, but even then, it's very hard to get a hit if you have three or four studios. But I guess they don't care about the money, I suppose. You know, it's a risk, but for us, we have so much money, it's a negligible amount we're going to invest there.
I don't know. I just haven't seen a lot of stuff out of that studio.
Well, I've played
Amazon game.
Yeah, the what's that esports? It's not Battle Right. It's a Battle Right like game, which I've played a little bit. It's fun enough, but when you have other, which one?
Breakaway.
Yeah, there you go. That's the one. The thing is, that one specifically is so borrowing from everything else and trying do it so specifically to be an esports, it's trying too hard. It feels like that way, at least. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that's kind of the challenge here. And maybe getting people like John Smedley and the others that they've hired is going to allow them to make interesting projects. Yeah, I don't know. I think the way I would look at it is, why not do it? You know, they can, they have the money, and they can try. If it works out, then it's cool. If not, whatever.
It seems like it was like director level or VP level person was like, I really like video games, so we should create a video game studio. And Amazon was like, okay, sure, do it.
Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I'm a huge fan of what they're doing. I think, you know, if the games succeed, amazing, great. But I guess, you know, when I first heard about it and when I saw what they were doing, I was a bit like, okay, well, we'll see.
Yeah, no, I agree.
It just doesn't seem like the thing that they would do, but they just went ahead and did it, which is good.
Yeah, it's also surprising how many different things Amazon is doing at the moment. You know, as I was saying, firing in all directions and on all cylinders. All of the cylinders are on fire, and yeah, it's just one more. So it's like if they had been doing only this and not 15 million other things that they would have been doing, I would have been more befuddled than I am now, I suppose. Conan Exiles is super popular. I didn't see that one coming. Honestly, For Honor is also a lot more hyped than I thought it was going to be. Those are the two games that I was looking at from a corner of my eye thinking, how are they going to do? But Conan Exiles is in early access and you know, it's one of those survival games in the Conan universe. And it's not only for the, you know, unsavory reasons that you might have heard about, it's getting a little bit of publicity. And as I said, For Honor came out yesterday, and I was very impressed initially, and then the hype sort of died down. And now I'm considering maybe I'm not going to buy it now, but it looks pretty good, and maybe when it's on sale in a few months, I might pick it up. Have you guys tried either of those? I'm guessing not, but
I've looked at Conan Exiles. I actually know someone who kind of helped worked on the game through like a friend of a friend kind of thing. It seems cool, but those kind of games just don't appeal to me that much.
It's very survival. Honor,
yeah. For Honor, I'm like you. I'm keeping an eye on it, and if it continues to get good reviews, and once the price goes down a little bit, I'll probably pick it up and try it out. But this first 3 months of 2017 is very front loaded.
Yeah,
so it's going to be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
My copy of For Honor is somewhere in the post. I should have been here 2 days ago.
But, I hate it when that happens.
I ordered it from Ubisoft directly, which is even worse. Because you think they'd they'd give it to you.
Should start depending on Amazon again, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Why wouldn't you purchase it digitally?
Oh, because I had some Ubisoft point thingies. I don't know. It was cheaper that way. Okay.
I'm completely on the Amazon like physical train. Since you get 20% off all purchases, all video game purchases, if it's physical. So I don't buy digital games unless it's like specifically on Steam. Actually, two of the PC games that I purchased last year, I literally bought the physical version, put the key in, and then threw away the box. And it just because it saved me $12.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have the Amazon Prime thing?
Yeah. Yeah. And the way it works is it's...
Does Patrick have it?
Oh, does Patrick, sorry.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I do.
But do you... You're in France, right?
So, currently I'm in Finland, but yeah, usually I'm in France, okay. And my Amazon Prime is France.
But when you buy games with a discount, you know, pre-order discount, how much do you get off?
I don't even know that we do get a discount in France yet. Maybe we do. I don't even know.
In the US, it's 20%, right, Ed?
Mm-hmm.
For me, in the UK, it's like £2, which is like $2.
Oh, really? Wow. $2.50. Yeah, that's like a normal, the normal like Amazon Prime reduction that they give to all the games. So I guess the video game little promotion thing is not like fully available yet outside the U.S.
Well, the thing is,
blame Brexit.
To be honest, the
because
games,
of Brexit,
probably the games are usually cheaper on Amazon anyway, like significantly cheaper. True. If you go to Micromania, which is the equivalent of GameStop, I think they own them. You're going to pay a good 20% more if you buy it there than if you pre-order it on Amazon. It's ridiculous. There is no reason to not pre-order it on Amazon, especially with the, you know, with the Prime, you get it usually on launch day, and it's cheaper than digital as well. It's, so
in the US, it's actually about the same. You end up paying, and it also depends on like the tax code in your state.
Of course,
whether you actually get taxed on it. So if in North Carolina where I am, it's exactly the same price as going out to a store and buying it. Mm. It's a little bit more controlled. Unless I buy it up to 2 weeks after the release date, and then it's $47.99 instead of $59.99.
Well, yeah.
Which
so
is
at
that's
at
cool.
least I guess if you go buy it on the in the store, you get it for. You're certain you get it on that day.
Yeah, on that day, exactly.
Poor Daniel. So I'm looking at the prices here for Zelda, for Breath of the Wild. It's €70 at Micromania, so the equivalent of GameStop. €70. And it's $52 at Amazon.
Wow, that's crazy. Now.
That's insane.
That's insane, yeah.
I mean, obviously, we talked about the issues with GameStop basically relying so much on pre-owned, and because I think they don't want to sell all that many items. And they do one thing which Amazon doesn't, is that they buy back your old games and your old consoles. And so they buy those, you finance your purchase of the new one by that way, and then they can sell the old one. And
a lot of people I know are financing their Switch purchases by selling their Xboxes and their old PS4s and stuff like that.
So I was looking at this, but here in Finland, I went to ask how much they would give me for it. It was €80 cash for the old Xbox One or the Wii U, the black one, the special edition. And so I was like, you know, $80. I'm an adult. I work. I don't think I can just. And you know, I also need to keep those for work in case something comes out.
Yeah, right.
If they gave me $200, obviously they wouldn't. It's sold almost at that price when it's new. But I don't know. For me, it's hard.
It was just like a cavalcade of coincidences all at the same time. Like Switch was announced, GameStop did their promotion, and Microsoft canceled Scalebound all at the same time.
I guess.
And so like all of a sudden people were like, hey, that Xbox over there, I'm not sure that that's gonna be worth it to keep around.
Yeah.
And it'll free up an HDMI port on my PC and my my TV, because I already have a HDMI switch that I use to switch between my game consoles, and that's completely full, and all the other ports are also full.
That's basically what I did. So I put I kept my Xbox One. I'm keeping it, but I put my Xbox One and my Wii U in the box, and they're available if I need them. But they're not connected.
So they're
to
not
the TV
they're not even they're not even connected to the TV anymore.
No. I just it's just, but work wise, it makes more sense to keep it in case I need it at some point.
You should have kept the Wii U plugged in and just play on the gamepad all the time.
I guess I
that's
could
what I
done.
Do. That's it. The only times I play on the gamepad is
I'm gonna have a Wii in a few days. So a Switch. Yeah. So
yeah, true.
Talking about things that are coming out in a few days. A really strange one. Horizon Zero Dawn is coming out in about 10 days. That's February 28. And what I was talking about before, which is there's no communications plan. There's no PR push. There's no marketing on that thing. I don't understand what's happening. And I wonder, is it a bad sign that, you know, it means... I can't imagine a publisher who believes a game is great or good and has the potential to sell well wouldn't make a marketing push. And to me, what that says is it seems like a bad sign for the quality of the game. I talked about this with a few friends on the on my Patreon Slack, and they mentioned, you know, maybe they're relying on another. Basically, we arrived to the conclusion that it's possible they're testing out a different strategy to push games, and that they think it's good, that it's going to get good word of mouth, that they're going to push it with influencers once it's out. And that they're saving on the marketing push and trying to lower the cost of those games. And this would be the perfect game to test this new method of, you know, marketing on, because it got a good buzz at E3. People have a general good idea of what it is. They think it's cool if it wasn't for that lack of marketing. So maybe they're trying it here and seeing if it works out. If it does, then it might mean they don't need to push every single game super hard in order to sell it a lot. I don't know which one of the two it is, but I think both might be true, but I'm still worried. What about you guys? Do you think it's worrisome that they're not pushing it from a marketing standpoint, Daniel?
I mean, they're clearly not spending a huge amount on marketing, but I have seen a few, I guess, more social ads rather than you know, big budget commercials and billboards and all that. But I don't see it having a negative effect hugely. But I mean, I guess for me, it seems okay, and I think we're so used now to seeing, you know, games that perhaps have a multiplayer component, have all these, you know, open betas and other kind of marketing tools and influences before the game comes out, promoting it, that, you know, those titles are becoming promoted a lot more, whereas single-player titles aren't. And I think maybe that's the effect there, because at the end of the day, they have marketed it quite well, in my opinion, at least. And there is good visibility for it, I think. I mean, based on what I've seen,
I guess I'm surprised I'm not seeing the big push towards the release. We're still 10 days away. Maybe there's time for it. But, yeah, I don't know. I guess we'll see once the game actually comes out. Couple of news on Konami, or Konami-related. Castlevania, which is, of course, a Konami game, is going to get an animation series on Netflix. I initially thought it was a live-action series, which I had mixed feelings about. I guess an animation series can be interesting. A little bit less groundbreaking, though. But still, I'm going to be following that. And then Konami also announced Bomber Girl, which, I don't know if you've seen the video, but it doesn't seem like the most exciting game ever. It's basically Bomberman with a slightly different view and anime character style promotion and a very slow moving character on screen. It's an arcades 4v4. The reason I mention it is that cool because Konami is still making games, I suppose. I still haven't, you know, gotten over my anger of what happened with Kojima, but I don't know. It's Konami is still special.
Is it only for arcades, or is it supposed to come out on consoles too?
So I believe initially it's for arcades, but but I don't know. It might come out for consoles afterwards. But when you look at the video, it doesn't seem like the most compelling gameplay ever. But
I mean, everything on their site, it's all in Japanese, but everything on their site, like, there's pictures of, like, the arcade things and things like that. So it doesn't look, and I don't see any, like, Sony logo or anything like that. So it doesn't seem like anything that will ever probably come west at all.
Yeah, but it is Konami making games, not just Pachinko and whatever else they're doing at the moment. So There you go. The Humble Bundle is having a special edition to fight Trump's travel ban, is how Polygon is titling it. And without getting to the politics of it, even if you don't care, I mean, unless you don't want to give money to the company, to the organizations that are helping refugees, it's organizations like Doctors Without Borders, the ACLU, things like that. Unless you actively don't want to give them money, I would seriously consider going to the Humble Bundle and looking at that bundle, because it's pretty insane. It has games like The Witness, Stardew Valley, Day of the Tentacle, the remastered edition. It has, I don't know, like Super Meat Boy, Sword and Sorcery, a bunch of stuff. It has books as well. It's kind of possibly the best Humble Bundle ever. So again, regardless of your political views, if you think those games might be interesting to you and you haven't picked them up yet, then go check it out.
It has a lot of cool little indie puzzlers on it. Mushroom 11, The Swapper, all three of those games are really good. Song of the Deep, which just came out last year, is on there. But like The Witness costs $40, I think it is, and the bundle together is $30, and you get, I can't even count this much, but it's like more than, it looks like more than 50 games.
Yeah. I think total. You know,
it's games and books and other things, but
yeah. There's like the Stanley Parable, Super Hexagon, like I have half those games. I still think it would be worth it for me to pay for it just for the other half. It's you know, Invisible Ink, which is one of the most acclaimed stealth indie game there. Well, it's half indie. From last year, it's really an incredible bundle. So anyway, there you go, you can go check that out. There's also something interesting happening, the Resist Jam, and again, political affiliations aside, what they're trying to do is get indie developers together, or developers together, to make games that are non-violent encouraged, and to make games that make you think about society. And some of the things that they're mentioning, I mean, one game as that they're using as a reference, which was really interesting, is Papers, Please, which, I mean, we're not going to go into what it is again, but if you know what it is, I think it's a very special type of game that goes beyond just a game. So this is really interesting. It runs from March 3rd to March 11th, and on top of being an interesting, you know, game jams are always interesting, or often interesting, this sort of direction makes it even more interesting, again, regardless of what your political affiliations are. So that is also something we'll have to follow and see if some nice, you know, different concepts emerge from it. I think did they mention This War of Mine? Maybe they didn't, but this is another one that is in that vein of, you know, games that make you think about stuff.
Or even something like That Dragon Cancer is another good example of a game that, like, is about a personal experience of the developer, and it gives you in the feels, you know, rather than in the more
in the,
like,
machine gun.
in the machine gun, exactly.
And finally, there was a little bit of a scandal story issue with PewDiePie and him being dropped by Disney and YouTube for some aspects of his business, which is not directly game related, but game related enough that I think I wanted to get my 2 cents on the matter. I actually posted a quick Twitter rant on Twitter, of all places, which I put together as a post on Facebook and on my personal website, patrickbeja.com. If you're interested in reading the whole thing, it's not very long. It's going to take you like a couple of minutes. But I did want to mention this because a lot of people have been talking about it in the past few days. And I think there are a lot of people who are taking this to extremes really in both directions. And if you're not aware, what happened was that PewDiePie did a number of references in different videos to Nazis and Hitler and anti-Semitism in what is, he says, were jokes. You know, he was he paid through a service online some, I can't remember where it was, but a couple of people in an impoverished country, he paid them $5 to hold out a poster saying death to all Jews. And there were, you know, it wasn't an isolated incident. It happened 6-7 times in different videos. And beyond that fiver, the thing he paid $5, kind of ickiness of paying money to people who have less money than you do to do something that is reprehensible and them laughing at them doing it and, you know, being shocked in the way that PewDiePie is shocked in his videos. That's sort of icky in its own right, but that's a different issue. A lot of people have been either, you know, yelling at PewDiePie for being an unconscionable anti-Semite, or, which was a lot more surprising to me, people defending him and saying, oh my God, I can't believe how the media is piling on him for this thing where clearly he's not an anti-Semite and you're manufacturing this outrage. And it seems to me that both, I think the issue is, let's imagine, and I think that's the case, I don't know the guy, but I imagine it seems to me that he's not actually trying to promote the, you know, ideology of Hitler Germany, Nazi Germany, right? He's not saying we should actually kill Jews. He was trying to make shock value jokes, in some cases trying to illustrate something very clumsily, and he went too far. And it is what happened was that there were consequences for him, and he, you know, is going to have business consequences for what he did, which was pushing the line. The line is very hard to define between humor and shocking humor and dark humor. And, you know, when you push it so far that it's not funny, I think he went on that side of the issue. And so some people said, hey, dude, that's too far. Let's cool it. And that's what we're going to do to send out a message. And that's completely fair. I don't see how that is unfair. And then some people are saying, oh, they're, you know, he's perfectly cool. People are piling on, referencing articles that are stating PewDiePie is anti-Semitic and saying, oh, no, of course not. He's not. And this is going too far. And I'm like, it's not really going too far. What he did borders or plain is anti-Semitic. It's fair to call him on it. He was reprimanded by the way society works as a whole. And that's it. I don't see how, you know, there's been people who have been saying, you know, basically getting outraged on his behalf, saying that other people were outraged on the Jews' behalf and that, oh my God, social justice warriors, and you shouldn't be outraged for other people. My response to this is, what are you talking about? You should only be outraged when something targets you specifically. That's how, you know, that's how it works. Like, let's imagine for a second that PewDiePie had said the same things about black people, referencing, you know, saying, ah, oh, those N-words should go back on their ships and with their chains and go back to Africa. The outrage would be much, much worse. And it would be justified. And I still would think that, I don't know that he would be a you know, a racist. For he was just, he's a clumsy, dumb, almost teenager, and he did a bad joke. And that's about it. But it's not unfair to call him for it. Like, people going on videos and going basically, leave PewDiePie alone, is like, no, he's not going to be tried for war crimes, but it's not like you should leave him alone because he did nothing wrong. It's fair to ask the question. So anyway, that was my, you know, my thought about this. I know it's a little bit outside of the realm of gaming, but it's still so, you know, he's a personality in the gaming space and it's been making a lot of noise. So I thought I wanted to address it. and basically call on everyone to sort of settle down. And it was dealt with appropriately. That's the worst part of this whole thing. It was dealt with appropriately. He's going to be fine. He still has 53 million followers on YouTube. He's still going to be making money. He got a slap on the wrist, which was warranted, and that's it. And I think another thing that came to me was, I think it's a generation thing as well. And some people might say it isn't, but for people like me who are maybe a little bit older, World War II and Nazi and you know, the Nazi ideology is a very, very serious matter. And you can joke about it, but you have to know when you're taking it too far. And I think this is eroding a little bit with the current generation and going forward, because it's just too far. People don't understand exactly what it was, or, you know, they have a vague feeling that, yes, it was bad. We know it was bad, but not, you know, we haven't. For me, my parents sort of lived through this, or, you know, my great uncles and these kinds of people. So it was part of my education growing up. I think it's less so when for people of PewDiePie's generation, who are 10, 15 years younger. So anyway, that was my two cents on the thing. My rent's over. I just wanted to put it out. Then I don't know if you guys want to comment. You don't have to. It's just my Patrick rent time. So.
I enjoy it. It was good to listen to.
Thank you. I try to make it to make these things interesting when I can.
I always like listening to people's opinions. So yeah, good to get different perspectives.
It started because a bunch of people in my gaming circles were commenting on it on Twitter, and it got into a very spirited conversation on Twitter, and we ended up mostly agreeing, which is, you know, it can happen, and ultimately we all saw common ground. There you go. Yeah, exactly. All right, and that's going to be it for the show. Thank you so much to both of you for being on. Would you want to say where we can find you if listeners want to get more of the dynamic duo of Ed and Dan? Daniel, why don't you start?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the best place for me is just Twitter. That's where I am pretty much most of the time these days. So my Twitter handle is... well, I mean, I guess you'll just include it in the link, like in the description, notes, yeah. Below. That's
absolutely.
Yeah, notes. That's it. So it'll be there, and if you want to follow me, you can. Usually, I'm posting random video game statistics and charts and all that nonsense.
Yeah.
So that's of interest. Yeah, fair enough.
I absolutely recommend it. It's interesting with every tweet. So thank you very much, Daniel. Ed, what about yourself?
Yeah, you can follow me personally on Twitter at Adesis. The site that I work for is called 4Player Network at 4playernetwork.com. We stream live every night on 4pp.tv or 4playernetwork.com/live. And we stream on Twitch to and we try to stream one of the people on the site streams every night, and the podcast for that is usually on Thursday nights. And I'm not personally on that podcast, but I do a lot of behind the scenes work for the website to kind of keep it up and running. And the last week I played on my personal day for streaming is on Mondays, and the last week I played Resident Evil, and I think next week I promised to play some Valkyria Chronicles. So if either of those two things are interesting to you, just come check out my stream, 4pp.tv, on Mondays.
There you go, and you'll find the link to the Twitter handle in the show notes, as always. For me, it's Not Patrick on Twitter and on Facebook. You can also find this show. And if you enjoy talking about politics a little bit more than I did today, you can find the Phileas Club on frenchspin.com. Both shows are available there. The Phileas Club is a show where we talk about politics with an international perspective, because we get people from different countries around the world, different cultures, to talk about the world's events. It's been focused on a certain topic a lot in recent days, but even then, you might get perspectives that you don't expect on that show. I always try to mix it up a little bit, so go check that out if you're interested. Again, you can also leave a review on iTunes, for example. Give us a few stars on iTunes. It helps us get a little bit more visibility for potential future listeners. That is extremely helpful. So if you have a couple of minutes to waste, you can go do that on iTunes or your podcast catalog of choice. And yeah, that's going to be it. We will be back in about 2 weeks. Talk to you then. Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.